is ready to hear argument in the second cause this morning. It's 10-0048, In Re Billy James Smith.
May it please the court, Mr. Moore will present argument for the relator. The relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. We're here this morning to discuss the statute codified at Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code, Section 103.001 et sec., otherwise known as an act relating to the compensation of persons wrongfully imprisoned. Before us today is an issue related to how to construe Section 103.001B. It relates to relator's claim here, Mr. Billy James Smith, of his wrongful conviction. Mr. Smith was arrested in 1986 in Dallas and convicted in 1987 of a rape that he did not commit. At the time of his arrest in 1986, Billy James Smith was serving parole on an offense that he'd obtained a conviction more than a decade prior. As a result of his conviction on the rape, a wrongful conviction, his parole was revoked and he was returned to prison both on the rape conviction, wrongful conviction, and on the parole revocation as a result of the wrongful conviction.
Counselor, is there a distinction between a parole and probation for the purpose of the statute?
For the purpose of the statute, Your Honor, no. No, in Ex parte Hill, the relator has cited in his petition, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals said that basically probation is the power of parole, which is otherwise reserved to the executive branch, now extended to the judiciary. In the United States Supreme Court case of Gagnon versus Scarpelli, which the respondent cites to, the United States Supreme Court said parole and probation, for all intents and purposes, substantively, are the ability to live and have liberty on certain conditions, and therefore when parole or probation is revoked, it's a revocation of liberty on conditions. So for the purposes of this case and this statute, which is a statute for the compensation of persons wrongfully imprisoned, we're talking about people that have lost their liberty for something they did not do and were returned to prison for something they did not do, whether that's probation or parole. The point here is that the only reason they were in prison was because of the wrongful conviction.
But does it matter if they were serving the sentence concurrently? And in this situation, I think the judge imposed a concurrent sentence for the previous violation to run with the new wrongfully issued conviction. Does that matter?
No, sir, it does not matter. Your Honor, based upon the fact that the concurrent sentence would not have been imposed but for the wrongful conviction in this case. And so, therefore, under the statute, and if you'd like, I'd read Section 103.001B, the relevant language in this case, which says, a person is not entitled to compensation under subsection A for any part of a sentence in prison during which the person was also serving a concurrent sentence for another crime to which subsection A does not apply. Subsection A being the part that allows you and makes you allows you the remedy of wrongful imprisonment compensation. Therefore, if you have that concurrent sentence and subsection A, you received a declaration of innocence, then that effectively nullifies the revocation which returned you to prison, which is the institution of the concurrent sentence.
To just talk about what's at stake here, under this statute, the comptroller agrees that your client's entitled to $1,593,000 and some change for 19 years and 11 months of improper imprisonment, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your claim is that, actually 19 years and 25 days is the comptroller's position. Your position is that your client is entitled to 19 years and 11 months of compensation, so another 10 additional months. And that the difference between what the comptrollers agreed to pay and what you say your client's entitled to is about $67,000. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, under lump sum payment, it's $67,000. Now, of course, the way this statute works is you get the lump sum payment, plus then you have that amount matched and put into annuity that's annuitized over the lifetime of the applicant. So, therefore, in this case, it's actually roughly $130,000 that's at issue. Of course, the construction here espoused by the respondent applies not only in Mr. Smith's case, but has far-reaching implications where you have exonerees who have been denied 95% of their compensation.
Well, what is the legislative purpose? It's clear that they're assuming that there will be some wrongful convictions and compensation will be paid, but statute says a person cannot receive that compensation for any part of a sentence during which the person was serving a concurrent sentence for another crime. What was the policy behind that?
The policy behind that was the fact that the intent of the legislature, of course, this court said in Laporte versus Barfield that intent of the legislature is the pole star of statutory construction. The intent of the legislature here is easily discerned from the title. We're talking about compensation to persons wrongfully imprisoned, and therefore Section 103.001B, if construed as we urge and as the Attorney General in their opinion construed it, is such that if you were in prison when you received a wrongful conviction, you don't get compensated for the time you were in prison, and you should have been in prison. It's a very simple and straightforward construction that fits within the old remedial scheme of this statute. And again, this is a remedial statute.
And is that what compels the result and the interpretation that you're advocating, the fact that it is a remedial statute intended to redress
Yes, Your Honor. The fact that it's a remedial statute should be construed broadly because it was intended to remedy the injustice of wrongful imprisonment and allow for compensation to deal with those problems that arise from wrongful imprisonment. Not only that, but I would point out that in 2009, when the Texas legislature met, passed the Timothy Cole Act, they did so at the behest of Texas municipalities, which were seeking to increase compensation to encourage exonerees to, instead of relying upon Section 1983 federal civil rights claims and going into federal court, they would instead now have enough incentive to take this statutory compensation and be able to go on with their life, have that wrong remedy. So therefore, if the respondent's construction is now allowed to stand, and any time a person was on parole at the time of their wrongful conviction and that parole was revoked on the basis of the wrongful conviction, then in many cases that could completely take the teeth out of this statute. Not only would it deny them the compensation and remedy that the legislature intended, but would also force many individuals, like for instance in the exoneree example that is now denied 95% of his compensation, his only remedy is to go back to federal court and seek damages against the municipality, which the legislature intended to try to prevent. Again, the respondent's construction urges that what we're asking is for this court to read in and amend into the statute the words in prison after concurrent sentence. But our reading of the statute, relying upon the Attorney General's opinion, relies upon the plain language. The plain language being that grammatical rules of construction here say that in prison is an indirect prepositional phrase. In prison, whereas it modifies any part of a sentence in prison, can also modify the noun sentence anywhere it's found within this section or within this sentence. So therefore, it can easily be found to modify any part of a sentence in prison during which the person was also serving a concurrent sentence. It doesn't ask the court to read in and amend, judicially amend, to put the words in prison after concurrent sentence, because grammar, the rules of grammar say you can read it that way. The intent of the legislature was that only compensation would be paid to people that have been wrongfully imprisoned.
What is the compensation for? What does it replace? Is it living expenses? Is it mental anguish? What is it for?
Good question, Your Honor. And in the realtor's reply, In the appendix is the legislative record from the Timothy Cole Act, where you'll find testimony and the words of legislators talking about this. And in fact, what it's for specifically is to mitigate the economic, physical, and emotional impact long-term imprisonment has had on the innocent that's been in prison. And so we're talking about lost wages. We're talking about, in fact, prior to 2009, there was a clause that allowed for mental health, for people to seek mental health treatment. That was taken out in 2009 simply because the legislature figured if they raised the levels far enough that people would be able to pay for their own health insurance, for their mental health, for their physical health, and be able to compensate those wrongs.
Well, you would think that someone who has committed another crime and is on probation for that crime, that person's economic wherewithal would be somewhat diminished. So would this, is this compensation, I mean, would it be sensible to conclude that the legislature did not want to spend the money to bridge that gap for the a person who had already committed a crime and therefore would have had a tough time economically anyway?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, under prior visions of this act, the levels were at, I believe, $25,000 per year, which would be more commensurate to just speaking about economic damages, because as you're right, if you were on parole, probation, most of the exonerees would not have been making, let's say, 1986, when Billy Smith was arrested, more than $12,000, $15,000 a year, and that may be optimistic. However, the intent of the legislature in 2009, when they passed the Tim Cole Act, was to look beyond simply the economic damages and go towards providing for all of the losses that they've had, of course, mental and physical health, and then economic. Understand that even if you were on parole, Billy Smith would have had 20 years in which to build a retirement, develop his skills, start a business, all of those things. So it'd be hard to anticipate what the imprisonment, the wrongful imprisonment, denied him as far as opportunity.
We're talking about a lot more than that, aren't we? We're talking about someone spending one day wrongfully accused, wrongfully convicted, and wrongfully in prison. And you multiply that by a factor of 19 years and 11 months, and there's, in my view, probably no value you can put on that.
No, Your Honor, and I believe if you spoke to any exoneree in the state of Texas, of which there are about 42 now, they will say that even the compensation levels currently set aren't going to compensate them adequately for what they've lost. Billy Smith, for instance, he might tell you that he never got to have a family, raise children. That's of particular importance to him. No amount of money, even at $80,000, $160,000, or $500,000 per year of incarceration, is going to compensate you for those losses. Absolutely. And in fact, that's why the legislature felt they had to reach these certain levels of compensation, because most exonerees were choosing to go the route of the 1983 civil rights claims because they felt that what the state was offering was simply not enough to compensate them was in many instances just to them inadequate, and so they would go seek the federal civil rights claim and then come back, as this court has recognized previously, and receive the statutory compensation. That's why the levels were placed so high in this instance, to try to encourage them to go ahead and take this money now and be able to get on with their lives and not spend the next 2, 3, 4 years in litigation over those matters.
Do you think that there was any reason to believe that this was passed perhaps as a detriment or to make prosecutors think through their case before they go after someone with weak evidence or no evidence?
Your Honor, I honestly can't speak to that simply because I, not being a prosecutor myself, I wouldn't know whether a prosecutor actually takes into account that if this conviction is later overturned, it's going to cost the state millions of dollars.
Probably not.
My guess would probably be not. How I think just the sheer number of exonerations that have happened in the state of Texas have been enough that cities like Dallas, Austin, Houston, Lubbock have taken a step back and started to relook at the way cases are prosecuted and even investigated in order to make sure that 20 years from now we're not here having this same discussion. In conclusion, it makes no sense to accept the respondent's construction of this statute, to narrowly construe it so that a person who should not have been in prison but for the wrongful conviction is now denied his wrongful imprisonment compensation. When he was denied his liberty because of a wrongful conviction, he should not now be denied his compensation. Thank you. I see my time's up. Thank you, the court.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. The court is ready to hear argument now from the real party in interest.
May it please the court, Mr. Leyenberger will present an argument for the real party in interest.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. At bottom, this case asks the court to choose between two fundamentally different constructions of the Wrongful Imprisonment Act. On the one hand, the comptroller has construed the provision in question according to its plain language. On the other hand, Mr. Smith asked the court to take the drastic step of creating a judicial amendment by inserting words into the provision that the legislature could have used but didn't. The comptroller offers two main reasons why the court should accept her construction instead of Mr. Smith's. One is the plain meaning rule, and the other is the rule of strict construction. And also, during the course of my presentation here today, I would like to address three very important questions that were asked of the relator. One has to do with the distinction between parole and probation. The other has to do with whether this is a remedial statute. And the third has to do with what is the proper way of reading this statutory provision grammatically.
Beginning with your first one, the distinction between parole and probation, is there a substantive difference? They're both criminal sentences, are they?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a very drastic distinction between the two. Probation is something that a court offers, and when someone receives a probated sentence, they don't actually serve a sentence. It is probated. It is postponed. Parole is different. Parole is someone who is already under a sentence. They are in prison. They have been sentenced. They've been punished. And the Board of Pardons and Paroles, Pardons and Paroles Review Board, grants them parole. Their sentence is not expunged. They are still under a sentence. They just now serve that sentence under the custody and control of the Pardons and Parole Division of the TDCJ instead of the Institutional Division of the TDCJ.
How do you respond to the argument that probation is essentially the power of parole extended by the legislature to the judiciary?
Both probation and parole are forms of conditional release. That is true. But it is not proper to say that the two are the same. They are different.
What are the practical differences?
The practical differences
when you're out and about under probation or under parole, what are the practical differences?
Well, under both, a person who is either on probation or parole are not free, as the relator suggests in their brief, that they're somehow out in society and they're free to come and go as they please. Both are under restrictions and conditions and that they must meet.
They're both under the criminal justice system, but there sure is a significant difference to be outside in the free world as opposed to being incarcerated in the not free world. You have to agree with that.
Absolutely. There is a difference, but The main difference is probation. Someone who is on probation has not been sentenced. Someone who is on parole is under a sentence.
But you can be sentenced even though you're under probation, assuming it's revoked.
You can, but if you complete your probation, you will not have ever suffered a criminal sentence.
What do we make of language that our court has used and the Court of Criminal Appeals has used, where we talk about people being, quote, sentenced to probation?
Well, I'm not sure what to make of that. If we could say that that is some loose language that doesn't take into consideration the very difference, the very meaningful differences between probation and parole. As I've cited in my brief, there are cases that say that there is a very drastic difference between the two.
The main one is someone
on probation isn't actually serving a sentence.
Is there any practical difference?
For example, do they both still have to report to someone in the criminal justice system? Do either one of them allow you freedom to travel anywhere without reporting in? Things of that nature.
My understanding is that you would have to report to a probation or a parole officer. A parolee has to literally sign a contract that contains certain conditions, and those conditions may be different depending on whether they're on parole or whether they're on probation.
Can both of them vote?
I don't believe. Well, a parolee has been convicted of a felony.
So no.
No.
But on probation?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm thinking since you have not been sentenced that you may still have your right to vote in that situation if you successfully complete your probation.
If a person is on probation or parole, they can still get a job and earn an income.
That's true.
If a person is in prison, they can't.
That is true.
Does that say anything about the purpose of the act, at least the part of the act to provide economic compensation? Because if you're out of prison, you can provide part of that, not maybe the lost wages, but part of that yourself by working. If you're in prison, you can't. What does that suggest about the interpretation of the statute?
Your Honor, that is a true statement. I'm not sure what it suggests about how to interpret the statute. What I would say with regard to how to interpret the statute is the legislature used certain words here, as it is constitutionally authorized to do. It may grant compensation for wrongful imprisonment under such regulations and limitations as it deems expedient. One of those limitations that the legislature has imposed here is a concurrent sentence. You do not get compensation for a period during which you were serving a concurrent sentence for another crime to which the act does not apply. The provision here does not say serving a concurrent sentence in prison. And
do you not think that reaches an absurd result?
I do not, Your Honor.
And why is that?
Because because the legislature has said you do not get compensation for that, and the absurd result that has been suggested here is if somehow a person has had their parole revoked and because of pre-2001 statutory provisions, their original sentence is prolonged and they end up serving a longer sentence than they would have originally served had they not been wrongfully imprisoned. Here, Mr. Smith did not serve, the record does not indicate that he served one day more on his sentence for a robbery than he would have served had he not been wrongfully imprisoned.
So he
had no prolonged period that would somehow decrease the amount of his compensation.
That reasoning seems to be flawed. You seem to want us to disregard the fact that he was wrongfully imprisoned. And you're saying that, but not, if that never would have happened, he still would have potentially had the risk of serving out the remainder of his original sentence.
I don't believe I'm saying that, Your Honor. I'm saying that the statute says if you're serving a concurrent sentence at the same time you're serving a wrongful sentence, you do not get compensation for it. And that's the way the comptroller has strictly construed it.
Let me ask you this. If there is no substantive difference between the probation and the parole, does the Attorney General opinion at issue here appropriately inform our decision in this case?
The Attorney General's opinion was appropriate to the question that it was asked.
But if there is no, if we conclude that there is no substantive difference between probation and parole.
Well, to say that, Your Honor would have to hold that a probated sentence is a sentence when there is case law that says someone who's on probation isn't serving a sentence.
But there's also case law that says that has referred to probation as a criminal sentence, correct?
I'm not versed in that, but the case law that I cite in my brief points out that there is a material difference between the two.
But I would like for you to answer Justice Guzman's question. If we find that there's not a substantive difference, then what do you say about the Attorney General's opinion?
Then the Attorney General's the problem with the Attorney General's opinion, the reason I'm having trouble answering that is because...
You're the Attorney General.
I am the Attorney General, but the Attorney General's opinion is premised on the fact that someone was not serving any sentence at the time. Someone was on probation. That sentence was revoked. I mean, the probation was revoked, and then they were serving a sentence. And that's why they say that the concurrent sentence actually came under subsection A instead of B. And therefore, B didn't apply, and therefore, they were entitled to compensation.
So it's a semantic difference, but insofar as incarceration, there is no difference, really, is there?
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that it is not just a matter of semantics. There's a material difference between parole and probation. And that's what makes the Attorney General's opinion different, a different situation than the one here.
So somebody who is incarcerated by virtue of a parole violation might feel, well, or a probation violation might feel better about it being incarcerated than someone who's been incarcerated because of a parole violation.
Well, they would feel worse about it in this sense. They weren't under a sentence, and because of the wrongful conviction, they are under a sentence. A parolee doesn't have the same complaint. They were already under a sentence, and that's what the plain language of subsection B implicates.
Would it make a difference that this court and the Court of Criminal Appeals has referred to individuals as being sentenced to probation? And that is that we have. Sentenced to probation.
I guess what I would point the court to was if we're looking for a definition of sentence here, we should go to the Code of Criminal Procedure. There's section 4202 of the Code of Criminal Procedure that describes what a sentence is. And that provision says a sentence is that part of a judgment that orders punishment to be carried into execution in the manner prescribed by law. A person on probation has not been sentenced. A person on parole is sentenced. They go to prison, and then later, because the Pardons and Parole Board find that they are entitled to or they should receive parole, their custody and control is transferred to a different division of the TDCJ.
Counsel, would you go to your second point, the remedial interpreting
Certainly.
The statute in that manner?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is not a remedial statute. A remedial statute is one that changes the common law or fixes perceived deficiencies in the common law. As we know from this court's decision in State versus Oakley, the common law never recognized. There was no such thing as a wrongful imprisonment claim at the common law. Therefore, And a remedial statute is something that either enlarges the common law or restrains the common law. Here, what we're not talking about a remedial statute. What we're talking about is a statute that creates a liability that is unknown to common law. And when you have that situation, the rule is one of strict statutory construction, that the court should look at the statute and, according to its plain, the plain language that it uses, and only apply it to persons who clearly come within its purview. This is not cited in my brief, but I want to take a moment to give the court the citation to this case for the rule regarding strict construction here. That is the Satterfield case, 448 Southwest 2nd, 456, Texas 1969, and that was a case involving a gas statute. There, the point was that we're talking about some statute that deprived a person of a common law right, and therefore the rule of strict construction would be applied, and that's where we get the rule of liabilities unknown to the common law are strictly construed.
So shift to argument three about how to read the statute grammatically.
Certainly. The relator makes a grammatical argument and suggests that there's a rule of grammar known as an indirect prepositional object that somehow is free-floating in the statute and may attach to words wherever I guess the relator thinks that they're appropriate to be attached.
Is that different from a dangling participle?
The way they're using it, yes. If the grammatical way to read this statute is when you look at the second half of the statute that talks about concurrent sentences, that is in a restrictive dependent clause, and the term a concurrent sentence is not followed by the prepositional phrase in prison that appears earlier in the main clause of the sentence. I know of no rule of grammar, and relator has not cited to one, that suggests that a preposition in a main clause that relates to some noun in the main clause can somehow be transferred to a dependent clause and some other word in that dependent clause. That is a very ungrammatical way of reading it, and it would be, frankly, silly to think that the legislature drafted it that way so that in prison could be implied.
We should not presume that the legislature did not study English.
Pardon me?
We don't want to presume the legislators did not study English when they were students.
I am not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. I'm going to presume that they did study English and that they knew what they were doing, and that this provision is written is grammatical, and the grammar here would suggest that in prison should not be implied after concurrent sentence in the second half of the provision.
Can I just get one question, factual question cleared. When Mr. Smith's parole was revoked, was he at that time incarcerated or not? Was he in prison and jail for this?
The timeline is this, Your Honor, and I believe you will find the best place to look for the timeline is in the party's briefs, but also you can look at respondent's mandamus record at page 53. There's a letter from the TDCJ that gives the relevant dates. I believe the dates go like this. On August 7th of 86, Mr. Smith was convicted, not convicted, but charged with the crime. And then on February 9th of 1987, he was sentenced. And then on the 25th of February of 87, he was put into TDCJ. But his sentence was made retroactive back to August the 7th of 86. So technically, he was serving a sentence all the way back to August 7th. His parole was revoked on May 1st, 1987. And then 41 days, that sentence discharged. So for about 267 days, he had not had his parole revoked, but he was technically serving a paroled sentence at the same time he was serving a prison sentence. And that's an interesting sort of quirk about this case, is technically he only served 41 days concurrently in prison with the wrongful sentence. So there was a very long, almost 267 days period where he was serving a concurrent sentence and technically serving a sentence in prison.
Let me ask you, just to be clear about one other thing. As you can tell from the questions, the comptroller's position might be stronger without the Attorney General's opinion, but the comptroller does not challenge the Attorney General's opinion. Is that correct?
No. In fact, Your Honor, the comptroller would say that it's consistent.
But she might argue that it's also wrong, and therefore she's right in this case. But she doesn't make that argument, or she does?
She has not argued that the I see my time is up. May I finish? She has not argued that the Attorney General's opinion is wrong. And in fact, she would take the position that she's being consistent with it and that the Attorney General's opinion just simply didn't address this situation here. They're two entirely different things, and we have to look at it in context. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court. If I could address briefly the fact question that was asked about the revocation of parole. The comptroller in Relator's appeal to his application provided documents to the comptroller to show that the parole revocation was as a result of the wrongful conviction. And I believe, but the documents are in the appendix to the Relator's petition, I believe that the parole revocation might have actually been retroactive to August 7th as well, the date of the arrest. I would have to check that for sure.
But do you agree that Mr. Smith was incarcerated only 41 days, that he might otherwise have been out on parole?
Absolutely not. He was, Your Honor, he was incarcerated for, as the counsel just mentioned, something like 247 days that he would have otherwise been out on parole, and then the parole would have discharged. He would have been free. He would have satisfied his conditions, and he would have been able to go on with life. I want to make it abundantly clear that Billy Smith would not have been in prison but for the wrongful conviction. The difference between parole and probation is really a difference of semantics. Ex parte Daniels, which the respondent cites to in his brief, and uses this language, there is a grave distinction. That is dicta within the context of there is a grave distinction between the procedure afforded a parole revocation as opposed to a probation revocation, not the status of being on parole, not the status of being on probation. They were looking to see whether it implicates double jeopardy, not to see what it means to be on parole or probation. And that is the only Texas case to which respondent cites in order to show that there's a difference between parole and probation. In fact, respondent cites to that U.S. Supreme Court case, Gagnon versus Scarpelli, respondents, counsel just said that there is no liberty. But in the United States Supreme Court said in both parole and probation there is liberty, there's conditions on their liberty, but who of us does not have conditions on our liberty? Every day we get up, we're free to go about our business, we're not free to speed or break laws. There's additional conditions, but they still have liberty. The U.S. Supreme Court recognized this and recognized there was due process that should be afforded when parole or probation should be
revoked. When was the Wrongful Imprisonment Act enacted? When did it become effective?
The original one was enacted in 1985. It was amended again in 2001, I believe, in 2007, and in 2009.
Do you recall who requested the Attorney General opinion?
The Attorney General opinion was actually a respondent's predecessor in office had a case come up and requested that opinion. The opinion was given in 2007. I would point out to the court that the legislature in 2009, in passing the Tim Cole Act, that was a radical amendment and overhaul of this legislation, and yet the Attorney General opinion was there. They knew it was there, and they didn't touch it.
Do you recall if when the Attorney General opinion was sort of under consideration, was there other litigation, not your case, but other litigation kind of ongoing related to the interpretation of these words?
None ongoing, Your Honor, as to the interpretation of these words that I know of. Of course, it arose from the litigation in the Tulia convictions, and that's where the Attorney General's opinion came from, as an individual that had been convicted in the Tulia drug bust and later had that conviction.
I only ask because, you know, the Attorney General usually declines to kind of weigh in if a matter presented is sort of embroiled in litigation somewhere. He sort of
I don't believe
defers.
So,
okay.
Your Honor. I would point out that the respondent's reasoning to differentiate the Attorney General opinion is after-the-fact reasoning. You will find nowhere in the Attorney General's opinion that says, I am basing this on the fact that this is probation and sentence has been deferred. In fact, the Attorney General's opinion uses the phrase in prison, that prepositional object, interchangeably with concurrent sentence and the sentence in prison on the wrongful conviction. It's interchangeably used to now come forward as the Attorney General, as the respondent's counsel does, and give another explanation for that opinion is not what the Attorney General had in mind from the actual text of the opinion.
Counsel, the Attorney General says that if we wanted to define a definition for the term sentence as used in this statute, it's found in the Code of Criminal Procedure. And where would you find the definition of the word sentence as used in this statute?
Well, I would find it in the Code of Criminal Procedure, but also in this court and the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals decisions on the matter that further define it and give an elucidate as far as the statutory language is concerned and how to apply that statutory language. I also want to point out that the strict rule of strict construction is based upon the idea of – oh, I'm sorry, my time's up.
You can conclude your thought, counsel, if you'd like.
Just on the point of strict construction, the rule of sovereign immunity, this court from its earliest days has said, implicates the right of a person to bring a lawsuit without the state's consent. This is an administrative proceeding. This court has already determined that where an administrative proceeding is implicated, it is not an abrogation of sovereign immunity.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. The court would once again like to thank all of you who have paid such rapt attention to these two arguments. They are excellent arguments in both cases, and we commend counsel both in this case and the one before it. Mayor McCart is here, I'm told, and we want to thank her for her presence here. We have members of the Amarillo Bar Association who've been very accommodating, and we thank you all for your presence. Want to pay special thanks to the students. You have seen government in action. This doesn't happen very often, and many of us were talking about this earlier, how we wish we had the opportunity to see this kind of proceeding when we were in high school or even college. There is another special guest here that I would ask Justice David Medina to recognize on behalf of the court.
I'd like to welcome Ms. Frances Warnick. She's a model citizen of Amarillo. She has been here since 8 years after the founding of the Bar Association, so you can do the math. It's a long time. Her late husband, Tommy Warnick, flew and trained B-29 pilots during World War II, and you know, Veterans Day is coming up, and we certainly thank all our veterans for their service. And her family founded the first abstract county in Potter County back in 1903. So, Ms. Warnick, I believe she's out here somewhere. We welcome you. Thank you very much.
There she is, right there. That concludes the arguments for the day. The court is going to take a brief recess, and then we will return for questions and answers. The clerk of the court will adjourn the court.